Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I want to say once again that I've raised concerns about these kinds of issues in the past, and I think that there has to be a balance in approving tax exemptions, because they're essentially a tax expenditure. When one does not have to pay taxes, it's the same as getting some direct subsidy from the city. I think that Commissioner Fish has done an outstanding job in addressing many of the concerns I had early on and balancing the public interest versus what is essentially a subsidy for this project. He's done that, I think, in a way that has not been done up to until he's become personally involved. And I understand that there's some concern about this, but the greater public good, I believe, is in following the law and making sure that we're as equitable as we can in the application of the law, and making sure all the T's and the I's are crossed and dotted. And Commissioner Fish has beyond met that, what I consider to be very high standard for me. So I'm pleased with his work and happy to vote aye.
Fritz.
This has been a very interesting project, and particularly for me, I was still puzzling over it late at midnight last night, so I wanted to explain how I got to the vote that I'm about to make. And thank you to the staff, both in Commissioner Fish's office, Bureau of Planning, Bureau of Housing, PDC. Everybody has been very helpful in figuring this out, and also citizen testimony has been outstanding, both in person and by email. I think that the application appears to meet the minimum standards for the transit-oriented tax abatement program specified in City Code Title III, and in one area has exceeded them by providing 25% affordable units rather than the required 20. Minor adjustments in design were made in response to the Design Commission's concerns. I recognize the investment of time and money the applicant has dedicated to the project already. My concern is that the existing standards for approval are not adequate. I greatly appreciate Commissioner Fish and his staff for the new process of reviewing tax abatement requests, with an additional round of analysis of the application by housing staff after planning has completed their review and the Portland Development Commission and the Planning Commission have given their approval. And as Commissioner Leonard said, we're talking about foregoing revenue that could otherwise be used for basic services in multiple jurisdictions. It's important to have good checks and balances throughout the review process. So let me say again, the staff work on this project and Commissioner Fish's revised process are absolutely how tax abatement projects should be analyzed clearly, objectively, and on the existing standards. My concern is that the existing standards are not adequate. The purpose of the tax-oriented tax abatement specified in Title III is to encourage the development of high-density housing and mixed-use projects affordable to a broad range of the general public on vacant or underutilized sites within walking distance of light rail or fixed route transit service, and to enhance the effectiveness of the light rail or fixed route transit system. Only some bus routes are eligible according to the authorizing ordinance in Title III. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard is eligible. The bus routes on Vancouver and Williams are not eligible. There's controversy over whether the property is within a quarter mile of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. But the standard in the code is whether the property is on the map, not whether it is actually within a quarter mile of the street. And this is an example of where I believe the standards in the codes need to be corrected. I'm concerned that the proposed development, which citizens have asserted is more than a quarter mile to the transit stop on the street eligible for this program, will not enhance the effectiveness of the number 6 bus. It is a stretch to suggest residents will walk 4 blocks to MLK when they might walk 1 block to Vancouver or catch the bus right outside on Williams. But those streets are not eligible for this tax abatement program. When I was on the Planning Commission, my job was to implement policies adopted by the City Council. I would have voted to approve the proposed tax abatement because it meets the standards for affordability, public amenities, and distance to transit, as evidenced by being in the shaded area on the map. But now I have to make decisions on policy issues. If I believe a policy is wrong, I want to effect changes in the policies. In the last 8 months, my colleagues have sometimes voted to waive standards to change policy for particular sites and situations. While I'm not a proponent of this approach in general, as a routine way of doing business, I understand that in some cases it may be necessary or viewed as necessary by some members of the council to do that. If we don't like the policies or we believe a project should go ahead or not go ahead in spite of them, we can vote to do that. We shouldn't do it often because everyone needs to know what the standards are and that the council will follow its own rules. But occasionally the rules don't produce the desired results. And this proposal may meet the letter of the standards set, but whether or not it does, I believe the standards are wrong. The public benefits pick list is out of date and does not provide the public with benefits above and beyond what a sensible developer would provide anyway in this day and age. The identified public benefits of car sharing space, ground floor commercial, and LEED certification silver are features seen in many new developments without tax abatements. Lack of windows in 24 bedrooms seems dangerous. Even though the building will be sprinkled, what about non-fire emergencies where a window exit might be needed, such as an intruder blocking the door? What about natural light and air? My concern is that the existing standards for approval are not adequate. And where will the children play who live in these 72 units? The only outdoor space is the parking lot. I would like the Portland plan to prioritize consideration of requiring useful common open space in multifamily developments. I support the transit-oriented tax abatement program when it is used close to transit with sensitivity to the neighborhoods it's designed to enhance. These tax subsidies should not be given without the highest level of scrutiny, especially in these tough times. And in this case, I believe a higher level of scrutiny reveals cracks in the proposal. The neighborhood and even the chair of the American Institute of Architects Design Committee came out in opposition to the design of the structure. It is far from the designated transit street. If we were certain we would be able to fund a streetcar on this section of MLK in the near future, my vote would be different. We will have that discussion this afternoon. But for now and for the next decade at least, the project is located on a bus line which is not a designated fixed route and not near light rail or streetcar. I don't think it qualifies as a transit-oriented development. I'd like the Planning Commission and the Design Review Commission to update the standards, maps, and the menu of public benefit options for future transit-oriented tax abatement requests, with different proximity and eligibility standards for developments on bus lines rather than fixed rail. As we heard in citizen testimony this morning, we have concerns about how decisions are made about bus routes, and we don't have very much input into that as a city council. So I can hardly believe I'm doing this after 18 years of looking at what the rules say and figuring out whether they're met or not, I can't in good conscience vote for this tax subsidy because I don't believe that the project meets the policy goals intended for the tax-oriented development program, and I would like to see the standards changed. No.
Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. So by way of, and thank you, Commissioner Fritz, for your thoughtful comments and the email you sent me earlier outlining those views. I appreciate that. Mayor, I want to give some background to the role that you've asked me to play on this, just because I think it sets the stage. You have requested that I, as the Housing Commissioner, take the lead in presenting tax abatement applications to the council. I think this one we can file under thankless tasks. And if there's anything I've done or said in the past that led you to this decision, I want to make amends, and I would certainly be open to Commissioner Fritz taking this responsibility over. But I think the logic of your request was that now that we have a new Portland Housing Bureau and we are merging and consolidating functions, it makes sense for the Housing Bureau to make a presentation and a recommendation to council. So I thank you for the confidence that you've shown in my new bureau. Also, by way of background, it was last year for the first time that we presented an annual report to council on tax abatements. That is something that a prior auditor said ought to be done. It's something that the council had said they'd like to see. And I think in particular, there was an interest in seeing what the foregone revenue was, not only to the city, but all of our jurisdictional partners. So I was proud to present the first annual report last fall of all of our tax abatement programs. We will be doing that again this fall, and also we will be reviewing all the abatement policies, taking into consideration comments from the public and from colleagues, and perhaps making recommendations to council for how we can update and fine-tune existing programs. Today, as soon as we're finished with this vote, I'll be coming back before you with a recommendation that the council terminate dozens of tax abatements under a number of our policies where the applicant no longer qualifies. And I think that is further evidence that our system is working, the system of oversight is functioning at a very high level, and ultimately we are accountable for how these dollars are spent. So that's the background that brings us to this particular application. And for me, the question that needs to be addressed is, does the Albert Apartments qualify for the transit-oriented development tax abatement? That's the question that has been in the pipeline now for a considerable period of time, and that is what I think our job is to review. And I would just put in the record that this has now been reviewed, I think, by five or six different levels of government. And that, in fact, can give us confidence that the question of whether it complies with the statute has been reviewed and looked at by lots of different eyes, beginning with the staff of the Bureau of Development Services, then the staff of the Portland Development Commission, then specifically by the Portland Development Commission Loan Committee, then by the Planning Commission staff, then by the Planning Commission itself, which unanimously approved this application, and then by my crack staff at the Portland Housing Bureau. Each of those levels of government have taken a look at this to determine whether it meets our code. The answer that each has reached is yes, and I think at this point it's beyond dispute that it does in fact qualify. On the one question that I've seen a lot of emails on, and I appreciate again all the emails I've received from neighbors and citizens and activists, we have spent a little time looking at the question of whether it falls within a quarter mile radius of a transit, of a qualifying transit area. That's an important question because if it didn't, it'd be outside the code. I think the most definitive answer I can give you on that is that we did a GIS survey, which I think is by law the most comprehensive review that you can do. And point to point, it's 1,190 feet. And for those of you who are statisticians, a quarter mile is 1,320 feet. So 1,190 feet clearly falls within the quarter mile and meets this test. So on the question of does it comply and does it meet the test strictly and either in the spirit, the question is yes. The second question that has been raised, and I think it's a valid question, is are there compelling reasons for us to turn down this application? The City Council is a check in this process, and technically we have broad authority to grant or deny an application. And we have the right to put our own judgments and to formulate our own standards. The standard that I'm going to apply today is there a compelling reason to turn it down? And the reason I'm going to apply a compelling reason standard is that this developer has gone a long way down a path that we laid out. He has played by the rules. And it seems to me for us to change the rules in the ninth inning, we would have to have a compelling reason, and frankly, it'd have to be based on some information that perhaps we didn't have available at an earlier stage of the process. So I've reviewed everything that's been submitted to me, and again, I want to thank people for all the time they took, particularly the concerned neighbors around this development who sent me very thoughtful emails, and thank my staff for the exchanges and the homework they did. So let's look at the compelling reasons that have been set forth. Number one is that we should deny this abatement application because of the size, mass, scale, and materials of the building. Or to put it in plain English, there are some people who think this is an ugly eyesore which doesn't belong in this particular place. I greatly respect people's views to come to different conclusions on the aesthetics of a building, but I would respectfully say that that's why we have both a planning commission to address the zoning issues and we have a design review process to address the aesthetics. And I think in terms of setting precedents, I am loath for us to usurp their authority because I think it opens up a Pandora's box. And frankly, we have citizens in those positions who give us very thoughtful judgments, and there are existing remedies that people can pursue. So I do not believe that's a compelling reason to deny this. The second, I think more fundamental question that's been raised is, does the abatement provide an inadequate public benefit? The code specifies what qualifies as a public benefit. At least one of my colleagues believes that the code needs to be revised and strengthened. I'm happy this fall to take any constructive suggestions and put them into our analysis and report back to council. I guess on this one, I'd like to just for a moment expand the frame of the lens to go a little bit beyond what our code says because I think we're missing the forest from the trees in terms of the public benefit here. The code specifies certain things you have to do, and that's been well documented. But I want to just put a little different flavor on it. 25% of the units in this particular development will be at 60% or below. And 60% MFI is what the city identifies as affordable housing. I would challenge anyone in this room to raise a family of four on 60% of MFI in this economy, but that's the sweet spot that we've identified. The federal government, which recently reprogrammed how they view poverty and came up with a different definition which doubled the number of elderly poor in our country because they took into consideration other factors. The federal government believes that 80% or less of MFI qualifies for affordable housing. So there's a little bit of a give. 21% of the units in this development will be at 80% or below. So approximately half the units will be affordable. And I don't want us to lose track of that because at the affordable scale and even above 80% to 100% in the workforce area, we have tremendous shortages of quality housing in those categories. This project clearly meets citywide goals in terms of affordable housing. This project, if it goes forward, and I remind people that it's currently a piece of barren dirt, which nothing has happened on for some time. And so if you want to just ask the question, is this abatement inducing something to happen, I would just look back on the history of this site, which is nothing has much happened. And so in granting this abatement, we will, in fact, be giving the green light to something productive happening. But let's look at the fees and SDCs. The total fees and SDCs in this development are close to $700,000, of which $180,000 will go to parks, not an insignificant amount of money, particularly in light of our discussion on Director Park, and $60,000 will go to schools. Let's look at the impact on property taxes, because one of the arguments has been that we're diverting money into something that's unproductive or inequitable. Currently, the owner pays $6,000 a year on property taxes on the naked dirt. When this building is constructed, it will generate $36,000 a year in property taxes, and that's during the first 10 years of the abatement, and at the end of the 10 years, that will go up dramatically. But we have other values that we believe provide an enormous public benefit. If you have noticed, as I have as your housing commissioner, there are very few cranes in the air in this city, and we have record-high unemployment in our building trades. This project, as with many of the smaller projects that are getting financing, will create good construction jobs in an economy that is hard hit. But let's get even more macro in terms of, because maybe I could be accused of being in the weeds on these things, let's open it up to a larger inquiry and ask, how does this particular development meet the larger goals which this council has articulated that drive all of our policy? Well, the transit-oriented development abatement, it turns out, is the centerpiece of the Obama administration's strategy of bringing transportation and housing issues together. It is their number one issue. It is the number one priority that they've established. And when Deputy Secretary Sims was in town a couple weeks ago, he engaged us on all of their creative thinking about how to enhance this program. Well, in addition to those benefits, we have a climate action plan, which we're going to act on soon, which is premised on the notion that we have to get people out of their cars, create 20-minute communities, and find ways of putting density where it belongs and creating a livable community. This clearly meets those goals. And I need not remind you, as we're having a robust community-wide debate about the urban growth boundary, that it is precisely the trade-off that Commissioner Leonard often reminds audiences that are upset with skinny lots or infill or density of any kind, that it is the trade-off we made to protect the areas outside of the city. We have chosen to take density, but in this instance, we're putting density where it meets our greatest goals as a community. So finally, for me, there's the last question that we can ask in terms of this, or a compelling reason, and that is, is there a precedent which we can look to which would say that at the 11th hour, at the end of a process where a developer has done everything that we have said he or she should do, that we should come in and change the rules and apply them retroactively? For those of you who are junkies of the Constitution, that would be called an ex post facto law. We can't do that in a criminal context, but I suppose nothing prevents us in a civil context from doing that, even if it wrecks a enormous inequity to someone who believes they have been playing by the rules. And on this one, I will simply say that I have a respectful disagreement with my colleague, Commissioner Fritz, because she has cited to me and to the council an example of this council waiving rules that apply to the placement of a neon sign above the McCall's building. a action that we took, and in fact, in fairness, she opposed and voted no on because she felt it was an improper precedent. But nonetheless, if we assume that that is the precedent that the council has established, I think it's fundamentally different, and here's why. We took that action at the outset of the process, before any action occurred to establish what the roadmap was going forward. And we did so because we thought there was a compelling reason to expedite the placement of that neon sign. We can argue the pluses or the minuses, but no one suffered a disadvantage in that process because ultimately the council would have been the final decision maker short of LUBA on that matter. Here, I think it's distinguishable because what we are saying is to a developer, even though you've complied with all of our code and even though you've met the objectives and the policies that we have articulated, we are considering changing our mind on the underlying policy and doing so at a time where it may imperil your project. And I think in terms of basic fairness, we can't do that. And I think that is a precedent that I am very reluctant to embrace. So for all of those reasons, and again, I want to thank everyone who took the time to educate me about their concerns and that what I think has been a very healthy debate, I vote aye.
Adams.
Wow. That was a tour de force, Commissioner, and very compelling. Seriously, very compelling. I'm impressed. And pleased because I made the assignment of this, what is a very thankless task of evaluation and recommendations on a very sensitive issue to Commissioner Fish and his team on the hopes that they would provide more analysis and evaluation of applications currently in the hopper and to make recommendations for improvement to the process in the future. And clearly, you and your team have exceeded my expectations, and I appreciate that. These projects are getting tougher evaluation than they have ever received in the nearly two decades that I've been around this institution, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate your willingness to take this on. I think that my observations of your work are also fortified by the 2/4 fifths that are also as part of this agenda where we are terminating abatements for failure to comply with the rules under which we approve them at the outset. So that also, I think, fortifies the fact that this city council and this city government, thanks to Commissioner Fish's leadership, is taking our responsibilities for all kinds of housing abatements much more seriously. For those reasons, I'm going to vote aye, and thank you. Aye. To get 4/5 on, remind me again, what do we do for 4/5?
Move to accept 4/5.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept 4/5. Any discussion? Carla, would you?
Yes, I do have a point. Have the affected property owners, are they notified about this?
Yes, I can, and I appreciate the commissioner.
We're just getting them on the agenda right now with this motion.
No, but I mean, well, that's a fair question.
And
and I want to just, I apologize that we were required to go through the late filing process and seek 4/5, but I will, as we will certify in the presentation, property owners a while ago were given this date as the date to come forward if they had an objection. So it was simply a filing matter, not a notice question.
Okay. Good.
All right, Carla, would you please call the roll on the motion?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
So just for those who are confused at home, what we're doing here is that there's something that wasn't on the agenda that was posted last week that we're four out of five of us said, yes, we should put it on today's agenda, and then we're just moving to do that. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. All right. 1291-1 and 1292-2 are now on the agenda. And Carla, could you please read the titles?
Mm-hmm. 1291-1, terminate transit-oriented development and multiple unit housing limited tax exemptions. 1291-2, terminate existing and deny applications for limited tax exemption for single family new construction and residential rehabilitation.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. This is the second time since I've had the privilege of serving on this council that we've come before you with recommendations to terminate tax abatements. The last time we did this, we learned a lot about what the council required and how to streamline the process. So Shelley Hack is here. Shelley is one of my new big catches. She's coming over from the Portland Development Commission to the Portland Housing Bureau. She's going to do a very brief presentation to give you the context for this, and then we'll see whether anybody has availed themselves of an opportunity to come before council and seek redress. Shelley?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Again, I'm Shelley Hack. I'm the current co-director of the PDC Housing Department and soon to be a member of the Portland Housing Bureau. I'm here today to report to you on the results of our annual monitoring of the ownership units that receive the limited tax abatement under the transit-oriented development, the new multi-unit development program, the single-family new construction, and the residential rehab programs. As a result of our monitoring, staff is recommending the termination of 68 abatements. And the purpose of this hearing is also to provide owners with the opportunity to show cause to you as the City Council as to why they believe their abatement should not be terminated. So the method that we used for monitoring was to work with the Multnomah County to compare the current tax rolls with the PDC tax abatement records to determine if the property tax bills were being mailed to the property address. And that's an indication, if there's a difference between those two addresses, it's an indication that the property may be non-owner occupied. Was also to compare the ownership records to see whether or not there was a change of ownership. And if the abatement was initially provided to the builder, whether or not the unit was sold or rented. Let's see. So we monitored a total of 1,242 units under the four programs. Of that, we questioned the eligibility of 141 units. And ultimately, after notifying those owners that we were questioning their eligibility, 68 owners were unable to demonstrate to us that they were eligible for the program, and thus we're recommending these for termination. And some of the reasons for these terminations are 34 of the units were no longer owner-occupied. 12 of the units, the developer had rented the properties, and thus the unit was no longer eligible. 12 of the properties, the new owner did not apply for the abatement, and therefore we were unable to determine whether or not the owner was within the income eligibility requirements. And 3 of the units were sold to ineligible buyers that did apply. And then 7 of the properties we discovered in consultation with Multnomah County, these were some very old tax abatements that somehow or another were approved that were outside of the home buyer opportunity area. So we're moving to terminate those as well. So of the 53, under the single-family new construction and the residential rehabilitation program, they operate under a different statute and a different code. And under that statute and that code, the Portland Development Commission is actually the appeal body. So 53 owners under those programs were sent certified letters, return receipt requested, notifying them that we intended to terminate their abatements and gave them instructions on how they could show cause. That hearing was held on August 26th, and nobody appeared to show cause. Under the TOD and the new multi-unit housing program, 15 owners were sent certified letters, and with the appeal date being today's date, that's again, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, was why we needed to move with the 3/5 process. And so those owners, if they chose to appear, are here today to ask or to share information with you as to why they feel their abatement should not be terminated. So with that, I'll end and answer any questions.
I think if you would just remain available, we'll put the lights back up and we'll see if anyone signed up. And then, Mayor, I think the last time you invited people to come forward, gave them 2 or 3 minutes to state their claim, and then we asked staff to come back and just tell us whether that was, in fact, a valid show cause.
Has anyone signed up?
We have one person, Tracy Olson.
Tracy Olson, are you here?
I think she signed up for another matter.
Oh, okay. And that was a second reading only. Mm-hmm. All right. So discussion from council. All right, Carla, okay.
Quick question. If we discovered that they weren't eligible in the past year, is there any way we get the money back?
That is up to the county tax assessor. And so the county tax assessor can make that determination. I believe in this case, as it relates to these seven abatements that were not eligible, the decision has been made to terminate the abatement today or as of this tax roll, but not to move backwards to recapture past taxes because the owners were acting in good faith. They received a notification of approval. They were put on the abatements. So they were acting in good faith.
Thank you. That's a good clarification.
So when you find that a recipient was acting in bad faith, that's where we would pursue.
Well, we could. Mayor, actually, it raises a good point. I mean, there's nothing that technically prevents us from looking back. We could randomly select some to see whether the disqualification should have occurred earlier. And I think that's something we could take up this fall in terms of our compliance and monitoring.
Right with you.
And if I could just add a note that with these terminations, a total of approximately $123,000 will come back on the tax rolls.
Great. Any additional council discussion on either one of these items?
Mayor, there's technically two different matters before.
Yep. So we're going to first call the roll on 1291-1.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Well, I want to first defend anyone up here who wants to vote any way they want for any reason. I have often been the lone vote on a number of issues I've later been told were not good votes. So that's our right, and we get to do that. Second, I think it's also important to acknowledge in this larger discussion what I can only call the absolutely impressive work of Commissioner Fish in addressing what have been historical concerns I've had with the administration of this program, the vote of which I'm about to take completes for me the entire circle, which is balanced with a more vigilant approach in awarding property tax abatements in the first place, but also as vigilant in making sure people play by the rules. And with this vote, we've seen Commissioner Fish is not only vigilant in overseeing the award of property tax abatements, as we always should have been, but I will tell you, until his arrival, we haven't been as good at it as we could have been. But second, and also making sure that once we agree to the rules, everybody plays by the rules. So a tip of the hat to Commissioner Fish and your staff. You're doing really good work. Aye.
Fritz?
Well, one of the things I really like about serving on the council is that we can have vigorous and well thought out disagreements, respectful disagreements between colleagues, and then the very next item we get to something which is way, absolutely fantastic that we are following up. And again, great staff work as in the previous item and great work by Commissioner Fish. I certainly appreciate that. And we want the taxpayers to know that we are following up, that staff is doing their homework, and that we're making sure not only that we have a good public process to give the abatements in the first place, and we're also checking up to make sure that they go to the right people. And I particularly appreciate your comment about the good faith that many of these property owners went into applying for the abatement, that sometimes the rules are a little complicated, and most people don't try to game the system, and then nobody has come here to protest their terminations, so that it seems like once evidence is presented that folks are not eligible for it, then they're accepting of that. So I agree with Commissioner Leonard. This is a very good process, and I'm very happy to vote aye.
Fish?
Thank you. We will continue to be vigilant in monitoring all these tax abatement programs to make sure both that the policy goals are being advanced and that only eligible owners are receiving the benefits of the programs. And we want to be very clear to Portland taxpayers that only deserving owners who meet our criteria on a continuing basis will continue to get these abatements. Shelley, thank you for your good work. Kate Allen, Beth Kay and Comey Calabar of the Portland Housing Bureau, and of course Barbara Sachs from Planning. Thank you all for the work you put into this, and I'm pleased to vote aye.
Adams.
Aye. Please call the vote for the roll for 1291-2.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 1291-1 and 2 are approved. That gets us back to the regular agenda. Can you please read the title for Council Resolution, item number 1281?
Celebrate September as National Preparedness Month by promoting employee and bureau commitment to emergency preparedness, education, hazard mitigation, and participation in coordinated emergency planning.
This just, it's a national month of recognition for emergency preparedness, and we'll be expeditious in our presentation of this resolution, but Commissioner Leonard and I thought that it was very important given what we might face this winter with the possibility of H1N1 flu virus, both the reality of it and the fear of it. We also hopefully will not experience another once in every 50-year winter storm this winter, but with climate change, we're not as certain as we've been in the past. And it gives us an opportunity in doing so in reminding Portlanders that we are entering the flu and inclement weather season, and we all need to be prepared. And with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Leonard for his opening remarks.
Well, clearly I wasn't prepared for National Preparedness Month by not being here. So thank you for, we do have National Preparedness Month, and this month, as you will hear, the Water Bureau and PALM have partnered to make sure that we emphasize a particular area to be prepared on in the upcoming, not upcoming, but hopefully minimal impact of the swine flu pandemic. And again, I'm certainly proud of the Portland Water Bureau and their proactive efforts in our community, but it's particularly pleasing to see this closer and closer relationship between them and PALM, which, as you know, Mayor, will manifest itself into actually a merging of the communications operations soon out at the site of the 911 center. We've purchased the houses, cleared the field, ready to start construction. So the Water Bureau will be a key partner in that with PALM, and I'm really, really proud of the work they do. Go ahead.
And the disaster planning council for city government has been meeting with the county, who's lead in responding to health issues like the flu. And we've also been meeting with partners, regional partners outside the city of Portland, but within the region as well, in preparation for our winter events. Who's going to go first?
I am.
Okay.
Morning. I'm Patty Reuter with Portland Office of Emergency Management. I'm the planning manager. I want to reiterate that we, with the Water Bureau, have a strong relationship, stronger than we've ever had. And this is because of the leadership of Council and David Schaff that we are being able to work with them, and that they have the priority of emergency preparedness for not only the Water Bureau, but to help us. And that's been really great. What is happening with the H1N1 is a citywide, bureau-wide employee.
Why don't you explain what that is for people?
Oh, H1N1, that's the classification of the virus, which is also called swine flu. So this is the flu that is coming up. We had a little bout with it earlier on this year. It is not the seasonal flu. It is different than the seasonal flu. It is the one that is deemed to be a pandemic across the world. But we can take measures that will lessen the impact of the flu. But one of the things that comes out of the preparation of this flu is that every employee, every bureau, and the council members need to do is have a continuity of operations plan. One of the effects of the flu is that people will get sick. People will get sick, and that means less workforce. That means that you have to reconsider what is essential for a bureau to do, and you need to think about...
Or kids will get sick, or a...
Or kids will get sick.
Domestic partner will get sick.
Right. And so we need to prepare not only our city, but our families, and businesses need to prepare. And David is going to go into a little bit more about what that is, that preparedness action is going to be. But just as the Travel Portland presentation showed, we have a lot to protect in Portland and a lot to prepare for in managing a disaster. A disaster is not the hazard. It is the reaction of the people. And so the more that we prepare the people, the more we're able to manage the disaster that could be the result of a hazard. Our hazards are not only winter weather, cold and extreme hot temperatures, wildland-urban interface fires, landslides, earthquake, terrorism, and now the H1N1 flu virus. We have many things that are going on right now in the city that are preparedness activities. One is the continuity of operations planning, which every bureau across the city is preparing, is participating in. We have the hazard mitigation plan, which the focus is to lessen loss of the impact of all of the hazards that I previously mentioned. And we have many, many bureaus that are a part of that, and four bureaus which received $3 million altogether for actions that mitigated the loss for wildland urban interface, for flooding, and for water water management plans. And the Water Bureau received quite a bit for mitigating the conduits up to the full run. I'm going. There's just a lot I have to say.
And maybe we should give them the website where they can read more.
But I want to tell
you
that...
Don't steal her show now, Mayor. This is, you guys put on these long, exhausting things that Dan and I suffer through, and it's my one little deal. Let her go.
No, this is jointly introduced by us.
Okay.
Love your enthusiasm and your attention to detail.
Okay, I just have a few more words.
You go right ahead. You go right ahead.
Mitigation planning, very important. We're all doing it. It's not just the response bureaus of fire and police that are part of emergency management. It is all of the bureaus of the City of Portland. We are working on UASI, which is Urban Area Security Initiative. 9/11 is coming up. Anniversary, terrorism plans are going into place, and we have been doing planning regionally since 9/11 for protecting our assets. Fuel contingency planning, very important. We're moving forward with that with all of our utilities and all of our fuel resources in the Northwest Industrial Area. Winter weather, of course, we're learning from last year and the year before, preparing our responding bureaus for being better. That's what every hazard, every disaster does. We become better. And the wildland urban interface fire is very important because we have so much to protect in our natural resources. And BES Parks and POEM have been working together to protect our fires, our fuel load for fires.
Which
we don't want to be like Carol.
Forest Park, Powell Butte. That some of our residents take for granted, but could be fuels for a conflagration.
Yes, we don't want to be California.
Right, exactly.
So with that, I'm going to turn it over to David Schaff.
Thank you, Patty.
Good morning. I'm David Schaff, the director of the Portland Water Bureau. I'm pleased to partner with POEM in sponsoring the distribution of these little mini containers of hand sanitizers to all city employees in the next couple of weeks. That's to... as part of our effort to improve preparedness for pandemic influenza. We're also working with POEM on brown bags for awareness and preparedness for all potential hazards that city employees may encounter. You've heard me many times say that it takes approximately 600 people to run the Portland Water Bureau and provide clean, cold, cheap, and constant drinking water to a quarter of the state's population. The reality is it takes a lot more than that. We have to work with the city's entire workforce to do what we do. We rely on purchasing to get contracts out the door and vendors paid. We rely on OMF to run the city's financial system and generate employee paychecks. We rely on PBOT and BES to work with us to ensure our capital projects get done efficiently and on time. And we rely on you to authorize contracts to give us direction. And when you're not here, we don't get our jobs done. And when we can't get purchasing to produce contracts or generate contracts out the door, we can't get our work done. So when 40% of the city's workforce is not present, then we can't meet our service goals. We have to reprioritize what we do. We have to put some things aside.
Let's put in context, that 40% would be the number if we got hit with the swine flu.
That is current estimates that 40 to 50% of the population could be affected by swine flu.
You're not suggesting, for people watching, that there are 40% people home today.
No.
This is an effort you're undertaking to prevent that from happening.
And that's why we're sponsoring this resolution, and that's why we're sponsoring passing these out. Our message for the upcoming flu season is cover your cough, wash your hands, stay home if you're sick. This resolution and these hand sanitizers will help drive that home. Thank you.
Discussions from council? And we'll be coming out in October with our plan specific to winter events, the winter weather events, I should say. All right. Anyone signed up to testify?
No one signed up.
Thank you both very much for your work, your leadership, and your passion for this. We're going to need it.
Thank you.
Please call the roll.
Saltzman?
Well, thank you for this presentation and for keeping preparedness foremost in our minds. Thank you. Aye.
Leonard.
Well, I want to acknowledge the succinct, concise manner in which you presented excellent information. Appreciate it very much. Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for the Portland Office of Emergency Management and the Water Bureau for taking the initiative to protect employees and our families from the flu season and the new flu virus, and for risk management for administering flu shots to city employees and their family members. And the message to everyone is wash your hands. You know, when I started nursing in nursing school 30 years ago, we spent 2 days learning how to wash our hands, and I thought that was ridiculous. And then every study I ever saw in my 27 years of nursing showed that it's washing your hands that makes the difference. And we're not talking a cursory dip your hands in cold water and move on. 15 seconds, which is how long it takes to sing happy birthday in your head. So I want to hear some humming from the men's room. Happy birthday. and this, you like this one. this is
let's
what?
Let's move on.
Call
the question.
The next tip I have is, this is one time where you don't want to conserve water by turning the tap off in the middle of it. You keep the water running. You want hot water. Stop it. Behave. And you use a paper towel to turn the tap off and to open the door. I'm going
to
give you all a lesson
my hands
on
right now.
Hand washing whether
I feel
you
like
it or
the
not.
Room.
The sanitizer. You know, when I started 30 years ago, there was concern that if nurses wore plastic gloves or latex gloves for every patient, that we were giving the message that somehow we thought the patient was dirty or that we were going to catch something. And now it's the standard. So if you're using hand sanitizer, it's not that you think the person that you've just shaken hands with has a problem. It's that that's what we should all be doing. And I'm going to be having a bottle on my front desk, as well as we currently have them.
A bottle of what, Commissioner Fritz?
After this one, I'm not sure. However, at least.
Neither am I.
That's actually been one of the most difficult parts of becoming a politician, is that I can't wash my hands after shaking hands with every single person. And that is how this virus in particular is going to get transmitted. So thank you very much for bringing this forward. Aye.
Fish.
David, you're a class act. And thanks for the thanks for the excellent presentation and your team. And I feel better just knowing that you and Carmen are on the job. So thank you. Aye.
Adams.
Thank you.
Aye.
That's right. All right. Please read the title for council calendar item, regular ordinance 1282.
Authorize a grant agreement with the Small Business Legal Clinic for $120,000 to provide continued support for two salaried positions, a clinical law professor and an operations manager.
Maggie, could you please come forward and skip? The Small Business Legal Clinic provides low or no cost legal assistance to low-income small businesses in the Portland metropolitan area. During each of these past 3 years, the City of Portland has provided the clinic with one-time grant money to support two salaried positions, a clinical law professor and an operations manager. The third salary position at the clinic, the executive director position, is paid for using other funding sources. This ordinance reauthorizes the City of Portland to provide continued one-time funding for 09-010, this has already been approved in the budget, to support the two positions mentioned. Now, when we have 7,000 new business license applications, new as above last year, and which speaks to the number of people that are unemployed often, trying to get into the profession of being an entrepreneur, and when we have so many businesses that are struggling to stay afloat, I can't think of a smarter investment for us to make. So, Skip, you want to make some introductory comments?
We put this on the regular agenda mainly because we wanted to highlight some of the great work that the SBLC is currently doing and provide an update, if you will, on some of the work they have been doing, especially in the last year. They recently undertook a study of some of their effectiveness, and Maggie's going to speak in greater detail about what that study revealed. And I can't underscore enough the importance of the work that SBLC does, especially in times like these, as the mayor pointed out. They focus primarily on businesses that can't afford legal representation, and that businesses that fall into that category include women, minorities, and recent immigrants as well. Additionally, the SBLC provides a fair amount of education to law students who are, you know, just trying to learn the tools of the trade and get their feet wet, which is an important service to the community, while also underscoring the importance of pro bono legal work.
Thank you, Skip.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me here. I'm really happy to be here, and I've got some, I think, really good news to support or to share with you. But before I begin, I just want to say really thank you so much, because without City Council and PDC, we wouldn't be here. I mean, we only got off the ground because of a generous grant from the city and from some really cheap rent from PDC. So we've been able to use that initial investment from the city to leverage some other support. We've got grants coming in from private foundations, from law firms, from banks, from other small businesses in the community, from individuals, from law students who've now graduated and have jobs, and believe it or not, from our clients who are actually now doing pretty well. They want to give back to the resource that they found so valuable. So the good news is that people do still like to support our business, but we're not immune from the recession either. We're finding that while people still want to give, they're not willing to make the longer-term commitment. Initially, we were getting 3-year commitments from firms and larger companies, and now they're still giving, but they're saying, I'm just going to commit to 1 year for right now, and we expect to give more, but we're not going to put ourselves on the hook. So we, too, are feeling the recession. At the same time, we're noticing that our waiting list, which has always been at least 40 people deep, is now between 60 and 80 people deep. Because of what Mayor Adams said a few minutes ago, so many people just can't find a job. So they've run out of unemployment, can't find a job, they've run out of their savings, and they just don't see themselves of having much of an option other than to try and strike out on their own, maybe with a friend, maybe hire someone else. So the good news is there's still a demand. We're doing well. We've been able to hire another clinical professor, so we're now at 3 people full-time, 2 professors, both of whom are lawyers, and 1 full-time staff. We have 2 part-time law clerks who work for us as well. Our clients have been doing really well. I gave you a handout of an email I got from a client because I really wanted to sort of underscore the types of businesses that we're working with. By and large, we're not working with venture capitalists or with businesses that are seeking venture capital funding. We're working with businesses who are just looking to, you know, feed their family, pay their rent. Some of them are going to be really big success stories someday, but most of them probably aren't. They just want to make a living and have a nice life for themselves. Most of them are not very well educated. Most of them, if not all of them, don't have access. None of them have access to traditional legal advice. If we weren't here, they wouldn't get the help. And the problem with that is that so many businesses fail because they didn't have the legal advice. They just didn't know what they were signing. They didn't understand their contract. Their lease escalates every year. It almost doubles, so they can't afford to pay their lease. And it's one thing if a business fails because it's not a good business plan or if it's because it's not a good product. But if it fails because they didn't understand the deal they were getting into, that is catastrophic and tragic, and that's what we really want to prevent. So as Skip had mentioned, we have just conducted a study. We just finished our 3rd year. So we've looked at the first 2 years of businesses that we've been working with. These results are very preliminary. We've got just about 50% reporting so far. And of the 50%, it's really great news. About 55% of those businesses were either brand new businesses or were within their first year of startup. And 22% were between 1 and 3 years old. And the balance, which was about 23%, were more than 3 years in existence. All of those businesses, 91% are still viable businesses, up and running, conducting business. 9% have been dissolved, and we're trying to look at, did they dissolve because they moved? Did they dissolve, you know, what are the reasons? But we're kind of understaffed, so we're working on that. Of those businesses, we've created at least 28 new full-time positions and at least 7 part-time positions. We're still collecting data, but we know of those so far. Most of the work that we did was regarding entity selection, formation, contract drafting, and regulatory compliance. As these businesses are now sort of growing and stabilizing, we're seeing more work on the intellectual property field and also in the leasing field. A lot of the businesses were working out of their homes or office sharing, and as they grow, we're sort of, you know, they're going to need to address those issues as they get bigger. Thankfully, just about everybody said they had a great experience. 96% have already recommended us to their friends and have would like to come back, but 88% said they will come back because the rest said they don't qualify anymore, which is good news to us. Our hope is that they continue to do well so that they can pay someone else to do their work for them. So that's what I wanted to tell you, and I'm happy to field any questions you have.
Discussion from council.
Did you move?
We did. We did. With growing, thank you for bringing that up. The result of growing means we've had a lot of people, and the PDC space was fantastic, but there weren't any walls, and we had some client confidential issues. As lawyers, we have, you guys probably know, pretty serious ethical and confidential requirements, so we had to move to a place where we could put in walls. PDC, we asked if they would let us, but the historical building wouldn't allow us to erect walls. So we're right down the street. We're on 4th and Oak in the Board of Trade building. So.
Thank you for your great work. We know your workload exceeds the resources you have on hand, and it's stressful for you and your team, and thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Not an emergency, right?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your work. I had known of what you do in the community. I was not aware that the city funded it, and it was one of the things that in the budget discussions Mayor Adams brought to my attention, and in the next sentence said, and we absolutely have to keep funding it. It's a fantastic program. So I commend the mayor for his leadership on this and for you for all of the work that you do, value added in the community. Thank you
very much.
Maggie, if I could just add, before I got elected, I actually practiced law. I try not to talk about that publicly, but the one of the most satisfying things I did was helping small business people with a dream get started. And in this town, they are frequently young people who are creative in some way. And what I think people sometimes may not understand is that if you don't have the money to pay for a lawyer, you're likely to go online, for example, and pick up forms on the internet. And I've always been surprised at how poor those forms are. But the benefits, you're not just helping people, you know, pursue a dream and create wealth and hire people, but if you're successful, you're keeping disputes out of court, which has huge benefits. You're also providing ongoing guidance and support. And the other thing that maybe people don't realize is there's no requirement in the legal profession that you provide pro bono services. People are shocked to hear that, but there is absolutely no mandatory pro bono. And at firms that charge a couple hundred dollars an hour minimum, that's really out of the reach of a lot of people. So to me, this is, in addition to all the other reasons we should do this, it's about leverage. And the council puts some money in a BEST program, which helps people leverage federal eligibility, their eligibility for federal benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a leverage piece. And the leverage here is amazing because if you're successful with someone, they become a taxpayer, an employer.
Right.
And if they do it meticulously, they're going to stay out of the kind of disputes that are avoidable if they have a lawyer walk them through it. So to me, it's a hugely positive program, and congratulations for your good work.
Well, thank you. And, you know, there have been some studies conducted that have actually shown that 98% of all businesses, the micro enterprises that we work with in particular, their first contact with a lawyer is when they're in trouble. And that's the problem. I mean, we want to teach them to plan, not how to react, because at that point it's too late. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you. Unless there are objections, Council Calendar Item 1282 moves to a second reading next week. Can you please read the title for Council Calendar Item Regular Ordinance 1284?
Vacate the public way between lots 13 and 14. Flora Meadows, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
So this is a vacation of a pedestrian path that is a public nuisance. Is there any reason that we should oppose this?
I've not heard any objections to this proposal.
Council, any discussion on this matter? Anyone wish to testify on Council Calendar Item 1284?
No one signed up.
Anyone here? 1284 moves to second reading next week. Can you please read the title for Emergency Ordinance Council Calendar Item 1285?
Authorized charitable organizations eligible to participate in the City 2010 Combined Charitable Campaign.
Good morning. Thanks for your patience. Appreciate you waiting. What are we looking at this year for the charitable campaign?
Good morning. I'm Lisa Shaw with Office of Management and Finance, and this is Carol Whalen, who coordinates the City's charitable campaign. Well, we have 15 charities that are umbrella organizations, and they are actually